I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Paul N. from San Diego.
My name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know, I remember when I first started going to speakers meeting, I always wondered how long they'd been sober. So my sobriety date is September 28, 1987. And that might not impress you, but it impresses the hell out of me, I tell you. One day at a time, it's like, wow. And congratulations to the cake takers tonight, you know, celebrating sobriety. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place I know where you get a medal for saving your own ass. It's like, you know, where else can you go? And I especially want to welcome the newcomers to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you what they told me when I got here. You might not want what we have, but it's the only place you can get rid of what you got. You know, and I hope you can stick around long enough to get what's really, really offered here in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a whole package deal if you're willing to do the work. And I've been willing to do the work, and as a result, I've got the benefits that it tells me I'm going to get in the book, you know? And that wasn't really what I wanted when I got here. You know, I don't know. I my thinking was always off from as far back as I can remember. I didn't start trying to drink until I was probably about 5-6 years old. And, you know, but, you know, I had a negative attitude right out of the chute, you know. That's what my mom told me a couple of years after I got sober. My mom told me I was born a cynic, you know. It was like that I was born old, you know. I had this attitude that just, I wasn't happy to be here. And I didn't like anything that was going on here. And I had, you know, a million questions that nobody ever answers were ever good enough for me. You know, it's like, man. And I would see certain things and hear different things, and it never made sense to me. All I could see was the hypocrisy of life. And, you know, I just, you know, no wonder I wanted to drink at 5, you know. It was like, man. But my parents drink martinis, and those are, I never liked martinis, even when I was really drinking. I mean, I drank them if I had to, but, you know. But, you know, I'd start trying to take sips of martinis, you know, that my parents drank, and I could never get enough down to get the effect. And I didn't know what the lure was, but I knew that they did it every day, so there must be something good there, you know. And you didn't open your mouth or anything when they were doing this, or you got hit, you know. It was like, this was adult time and you get lost, you know. It was like, okay. And sometimes I stopped and sometimes I didn't. And, you know, I didn't grow up in, like, one of these warm Leave It to Beaver families. You know, dinner time was the worst time of all, because that's usually when my mom told my dad what was going on. So me and my brother, and that's usually when the crazy shit started, you know. It's like, okay. And my family was better to be fast than anything else, you know. That's what it was. And, you know, I learned to run, and I also learned to be really hypersensitive to my environments, because I had to know when shit was coming down, so I had to prepare myself. And you know, that's just the way that I started living at a young age. And you know, I was always looking for an out, always looking. And you know, I had this complex, this, you know, I wasn't okay with who I was from a very young age, so I was always trying to be somebody that I wasn't. And you know, some stuff happened, and my youngest brother was born you know, not like everybody else in this room. He had, you know, Down syndrome, and he had some physical problems. And my parents ended up giving it, they didn't know what to do, so they ended up giving it to the state of California. Now, I internalized this, and the message that I got was, if you're not perfect, you're going to get rid of too. So I grew up really, really afraid, you know, for a while. But, you know, I got to that point when I was about 12, 13 years old, where I said, you know what, this ain't working. I'm not getting what I want. And I found alcohol, you know. It's like, wow. And I always knew that my thinking was just a little bit different from other people's. I was, you know, I don't know, about 8, 9 years old, and I got caught stealing in a store, which I did quite frequently. You know, before it was booze, it was candy, you know. It was like anything, you know. I needed something to fill that void inside of me. And I tried a lot of different things before I found alcohol. But alcohol worked the best. But anyways, I was, you know, I got caught stealing. The kids got my little bike, or the cops got my bike in the little car, in the back of the car, and he's driving me downtown, you know, and I'm all, you know. My head isn't telling me that I did something wrong, don't do it again. My head's telling me, you got to learn how to do this better so you don't get caught the next time, you know. These are the things that I aspired to, was not getting caught. That was my main goal in life. You know, I was like, I didn't really care. You know, I mean, people had hopes and dreams about, you know, being a sports hero or Academy Awards or, you know, president and that kind of stuff. I just didn't want to get caught. You know, that was my goal. And my parents would tell me these things, like, you could be anything you wanted. And inside, I was like, yeah, right, you know. I mean, I had no self-esteem. I just didn't care about anything. I was pretty much hopeless at a very young age. And then I found alcohol. And I thought, man, this is what I've been looking for my whole life. Those fears went away. I could believe those old fantasies and dreams in my head, and I could believe them. And I could be whoever I wanted to be when I drank and believe it. You know, the real problems for me started when the alcohol started wearing off and reality started creeping in one more time. So there was a solution for that too, and that was don't stop, you know. Don't stop. And I started drinking. You know, we'd meet in this churchyard on the way to school and either, you know, smoke some stuff or drink. And sometimes we'd go to school and sometimes we wouldn't. That didn't seem like a real big priority to me. You know, my parents had hopes and dreams of me maybe going to college or something. And, you know, I was just trying to get through another day. Life was totally a struggle for me from that point, you know. And I didn't believe that I would ever be able to go to college. And I just had no hopes about anything. And the family was getting like crazier and crazier. My dad had some anger issues, you might say. And, you know, so quite frequently he would just tear things up in the house. You know, to me there was no apparent reason, but he had one. I don't know what it was. But, you know, my mom and my brother would be scared all the time. And as the older son in an alcoholic family, I kind of took this role on where I had to be like that. You know, it's like the cattle guard in the front of a train, man. You know, I take all the hits so the train behind me doesn't take so much. And that's what I did. You know, that was the role that I took on. And I was always arguing, I was fighting. You know, when the cops called my dad to come get me, he just said, keep him. You know, my buddy up the street, his dad was a drunk and too, but he was a different kind of drunk. He would stand up for us. He'd come down to the police station and raise hell, you know. You know, what are you doing arresting these kids for drinking? Come on, you know. You know, I mean, and the police station was in walking distance to our house, and he'd be drunk when he came down there. The cops would let him out, and he'd walk us home, you know, and I'd go to their house, not my house. It was like, you know, and we can hang out there. It was like, cool. But, you know, I just started drinking, and once I found this booze, I mean, it was just like magic for me. And it wasn't that everything was so great when I drank. It's just that it wasn't as bad as it was when I was sober. And I later found out that I'd been depressed for a long, long time and didn't really know it, you know, even as a young child. And I treated that depression with alcohol and drugs for a long time, you know, and it worked for a long time. And I did it for as long and as hard as I could until it didn't work anymore. And there were a lot of, man, you know, there were a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, I started getting in trouble, you know, like I said, pretty early. And, you know, that seemed like a really small price to pay considering what I was getting out of that drink, which for me was everything. You know, I mean, I got arrested quite a few times and, you know, did some really stupid stuff. And, you know, my mom used to volunteer to work in the guidance office at school so she could keep track of my attendance, you know. And, you know, I'd be on the back parking lot smoking cigarettes and dope and stuff and drinking. And she'd pull up, you know, to go do her volunteer work and yell at me to get to class and be like, yeah. And my friends say, hi, Mrs. Neighbor, you know. You know, and she'd go in there and they'd come home from school and like, you missed this, this, and this. I'm like, yeah, and, you know, what's your point? You know, I just didn't get it. I didn't get school. I didn't get anything but drinking, you know, and on it went. Got several car wrecks, lots of fights, you know, just arrested, all kinds of stuff as a young kid. And, you know, and I was still always looking for the easier, softer way, always. You know, I never wanted to do the work, but I always wanted all the gifts and the rewards. But I never wanted to do the work. And, you know, when we were kids, we, you know, this is like back in the 70s, and, you know, some of the really good marijuana was starting to come out then. And, you know, I grew up in a small town in Northern California, just north of San Francisco. And, you know, we got this great idea that we're going to be entrepreneurs, you know. It's like, we're going to, you know. And so what we did is, you know, and there was plenty of open space. It was like, okay, and people weren't really doing it like they do now, but... You know, and there weren't all these helicopters and all this radar and, you know, all the stuff they can see with now. Man, I'm glad I got sober when I did. It'd be so hard, you know. They got cameras everywhere now. It's like my, you know, and we got laws for everything. And the stuff that I used to do was just, they just let us go. Now they, you know, now you're a criminal. It's like, come on, you know. It's like, wow, you know. So I'm grateful that I did what I did when I did it. But, you know, we're going to be entrepreneurs. So we found this spot way on the sticks, and, you know, we cleared it, and we planted some plants, and we'd walk out, haul water out there and stuff. And, you know, the guys who I was doing with this were also alcoholics. And after about a week of doing this, we're like, man, you know what? This sucks, man. You know what? We'll let all the other guys do the work, and then we'll go steal the stuff in October, you know? And this is what I did. You know, I got shot at trying to steal dope, and I just thought that was part of the deal. You know, I didn't really care. As long as I got what I wanted, you know, it was like, oh, man. And the thought of dying didn't scare me all that much, you know, because I really didn't have much to live for. I didn't have any hopes. I didn't think I was going to be here very long. So I didn't really care. What I cared about was getting what I needed to get through another day. And for me, that was alcohol and drugs. And that's all that was important to me. And, you know, my parents asked me to leave home. Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, it's weird. My parents moved down to San Diego and I left home at the same time. But I got asked to leave and I got asked not to come down here, you know. I wasn't welcome to come down here, and that was, you know, and that was okay because I wanted to stay up there, and I thought I was a grown up, you know. I don't know who was happier that I got out of the house, me or my parents, you know. I put those people through hell. I wrecked every car they ever had. My mom was on first name basis with judges in Marin County, you know, because I'd have to go to court so much, you know. When my younger brother first got his license on his first ticket, he knew he was in trouble when the judge says, "Don't you have an older brother?" You know. It's like, oh, man, and they took his license on the first shot, you know. It's just like, okay, you know. It's just all this stuff was always happening over and over again. And, you know, when I moved out and I got an apartment and I got a job in San Francisco, and, man, I like, when I got this, you know, I lived about 10, 15 miles from San Francisco. And when I moved over there and started working there, it was like, this is amazing. You know, I could go into bars and they didn't care. I was 18 years old, but they didn't care. San Francisco is a pretty liberal town. And, you know, and I found people at work that like to go have a drink at lunchtime. I was like, shit, this is pretty good, man. I thought I was going to be sober all the time while I worked at this place. And I was always sneaking until that point, you know. I was like, wow. And so that's what I did, you know. And then I go to the bar after work. And I really like hanging out in bars, you know. And this particular bar, I never seem to make it to the real nice ones, you know. I remember when I first got sober and I'm walking down Cass Street and I'm looking at Cass Street Bar and Grill, looking in the windows and said, fuck, that looks great. And my next thought is, you never drank like that. You never drank like that. What makes you think it's going to be different now? You know? But I drank in them dark places with a crappy carpet and a red Naga hide, you know, and lots of mirrors, and they were really, really dark. And there was a good thing about this bar is it had a back door, and there was a little alley out the back where we could go out and do some other stuff. It was like, you know, this is a perfect spot. You know, and if the cops ever came in the front door, we could go out the back. It was like, you know, this ain't so bad. And I hung out in this spot all the time. You know, and I got a job, and, you know, and the guys that ran the bar were pretty cool. There was a whole group of Greek brothers, and, you know, they owned a couple bars in the neighborhood. And, you know, it wasn't too long after that that, you know, we could close the bar down, and they closed the front doors, and we could stay in there all night. And the building I worked at in San Francisco was like two doors down, so I could stay in there all night, do drugs and drink, gamble, and do all, we'd bring some girls in there too, and do whatever we had to do all night long. And then just in the morning, I could walk out the bar and everybody be getting off the BART trains and the subways and the buses, and I could flow right back into there and go right back into work again. You know, I was like, okay, with the same clothes on, reeking of booze and drugs, you know, an absolute just wasted out of my mind, and going to work for another day, and swear to God that I would stay, you know, that I would go home and sleep after that day, you know. But, you know, after 9 o'clock, my first morning break, I was over there getting a drink again. And at noon, I would go and get drunk and come back. Sometimes I'd come back to work, sometimes I wouldn't, you know. And I'd go on my afternoon break and drink. You know, I was like, oh, my God, you know, how do you do this? You know, how do you do this? And this company that I worked for must have been the most codependent company in the world. I swear to God. Because I can't they put up with so much crap for me, you know. And, you know, you really had to be a screw-up to get fired there, you know. I mean, one New Year's Eve, I got this real bright idea to, you know, I had access to vehicles there. God knows why, you know. I didn't even have a license, you know. But, you know, they get part of my job was driving. I was like, hey, that could cool with me, you know. But I lost my license a while ago, and cars had, at that point, you know, I was in my early 20s, and, you know, cars had become like a luxury item, you know. I was like, it's just too much work, man. Gas, you know. I mean, come on, you know. It was like, man, that's drinking money, you know, and oil and maintenance and all this stuff. You know, I'd just drive them until they died and just leave them, you know. And then I'd walk or hitchhike to work, you know. I was like, okay. So every dime that I had could go to drinking and drugs. I didn't care about this. I lived in this crappy little studio. Well, it wasn't crappy until I moved into the studio, you know. It wasn't, you know. But, I the power had been turned off so many times that there was a science experiment going in the refrigerator, you know. The only thing we wanted to put in there was sealed containers, you know, and nothing else, because everything else was green and growing in there. I didn't know how to take care of myself, and I didn't really care. You know, I have one of those kind of ovens, when you turned it on, you know, it always caught on fire because there was so much crap inside of it, you know. It was just like, you know, the sink had been stopped up for I don't know how long, you know. It was like I threw everything down the toilet, you know. These are my solutions, you know. It's like, you know, it was like, my God, you know. And I lived like a total, you know, I just lived like a total slob, like a total alcoholic. You know, and there used to be this guy that lived in, it was a whole group of two fourplexes of studio apartments. And there was a guy that lived across the way from me. He was probably 10, 15 years older than me at the time. And he was a real alcoholic, okay? You know, he'd sit up in his apartment and play this like Tony Bennett and, you know, Dean Martin music all night long and just crank it on these hot summer nights. And, you know, and just drive everybody crazy. And what we would do is, me and the other guy that lived on the other side of him, we'd go up there and tie this rope to his front door, tie it to the banister out in front so he couldn't get out of the door. And then we'd go over and turn his power off, you know, so he couldn't have his music or his lights, you know, because he just drove everybody crazy, you know. And then he'd be up there howling like a wounded animal for hours, you know. It was like, you know, and here I am, I'm all fucked up. I can't take, you know, I can barely eat. My lights are off half the time. And he's a real alcoholic, you know. I mean, he, you know, and he used to go out in the middle of the night in these blackouts and pop the tires in his own car, and he believed it so much that he parked his car a mile away from the apartments because people were after him, you know. I was like, man, I was like, you know, as long as I had somebody to look down on, I was okay. As long as there was somebody worse, I thought I could keep going, you know. And that's what happened, you know. And, you know, he'd come out of these drunks, and he'd give me a ride to work after I did this shit. You know, I couldn't stand the guy except when he was sober, you know, and I could barely tolerate him then. But if he was going to give me a ride to the city, it wasn't so bad, you know. I was always looking to use people for something. Always. I didn't know how to have friendships with people at all. You know, there was always had to be something in it for me. And that's what I kind of thought life was about, man. There was nobody was going to give me anything. So it's up to me to go out and take it, you know. And I'm never going to make enough money to go buy it. So, you know, I got to go take it. And that's what I thought was going to lead me to being happy, joyous, and free. And, you know, but the trouble was I couldn't stop drinking. You know, and, you know, I started, you know, when some of the other substances started coming into my life too, you know, I thought I was going to be this big wheeler dealer. The problem was I could never get rid of anything fast enough to sell any, you know. I mean, I have these grandiose ideas about making all this money, but the truth was, as soon as I got something, I would hole up and do it all till it was gone. You know? Whatever it was, you know? That's just the way that I was. There was no control, man. It was like, from the time I first picked up that first drink, it was like, man. And, you know, but I had access to these vehicles. I'm jumping around, but, you know, at this company I work for, and I got this great idea to borrow a van on New Year's Eve, you know? And threw a couch and a couple chairs in the back of this van, and, you know, threw a whole bunch of people in there from the city, and, you know, we went cruising around. I don't even, you know, I blacked out at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I have no idea what happened, you know. I don't know, you know. I mean, I don't know until about an eighth of a second before I was coming home. It was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and an eighth of a second, and I'm aimed right at the Golden Gate Bridge Toll Plaza. And I slam into this thing, man. And the company car, I rolled this van. You know, and if I wasn't drunk, I probably would have got killed, you know, but I was so drunk that I just couldn't, you know, went with the van, you know, and it ended up rolling a few times, and I wake up, I come to again, and I'm looking out, and I'm on my side, on the passenger side, and I'm like, how did this happen, you know, and, you know, windshield's gone, and so I, you know, and I hear these brakes, man, so I was like, man, so I instinctively crawl out of this van and start backing up. And this guy smashes into the van while it's upside down, you know. And I'm standing on the bridge. I'm going, where am I going to run to? You know, the cops are going to be coming soon. You know, that's not worth going over the side for this, you know. It was like, you know, it's like, and what happened was, this guy and this girl get out in the middle of traffic on the Golden Gate Bridge. Cars are zipping by 50, 60 miles an hour, and they start having a fight. She's ripping him a new one. I told you, you stupid drunk man, you know, you shouldn't be driving. And he's trying to get her to get behind the wheel so he didn't go to jail again. And this comedy is going on right in front of me. I'm like, this is absolutely insane. But my life was absolutely insane. You know, things like this were going on all the time. You know, and we both went to jail, you know. You know, and we're both from Marin County. We're begging the cops to take us to jail in Marin County instead of San Francisco because I didn't know how I was going to get home. I didn't have a dime left in my pocket, you know, as usual. And I didn't want to go to San Francisco. The Marin County jail was a lot nicer than the one in San Francisco down on Bryant Street. A lot nicer, you know, it was a lot cleaner. But no, I got to go to San Francisco, you know. I was like, okay. You know, and I came out, and this was on New Year's Day, you know, and I got out of jail, and going, man, this is going to be a great year, you know. I'm like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, here we go again. Here we go again. And that was in my very early 20s, you know. And I had to go in and tell the boss. I thought for sure I was going to lose my job. You know, I walked in there and told him what happened. It was like, you know what, even I can't lie about this one, you know. And I told him what happened. He says, well, let's see what we can do. And I didn't get fired. I was like, you know, I was like, my God, how did this happen? You know, and later times, you know, I mean, I would get sometimes, you know, I did things on the weekend, and I was at this park with some friends who were barbecuing, and you know, this cop's driving through, their mad dog and everybody, and you know, I could not resist the urge just to flip them off. You know, I'm like, you know, where does this come from? You know, but I just had to do it. Next thing you know, I'm getting hooked up again. My friend's kids are in tears because they don't understand what happened, and I'm going to jail again on a Sunday. I'm like, oh man. And I called work from jail, you know, and said, look, you know, and my buddy had told him this big story that I got hit in the head with a bat in a softball game and I'm not going to be at work for a while, you know, but he had no way of telling me. So I called my boss and said, you know what, I'm in jail. I'm not going to be there. I don't know when I'm getting out. You know, they arrested me in a couple counties different than where I had my warrant. So it takes a while to get down to the right one to get processed. And I was like, oh, man, you know, and she's like, okay, you know, well, let me know when you're out. And, you know, it's like, and I wasn't the first one at this place to go to jail and come back to work, you know. I was like, oh, okay, you know, I thought for sure I was going to be fired, you know, and I wasn't, you know. I was like, wow, you know, one lunch hour, I was out selling some drugs to a girl, and I'd already been drinking that day, and the cops chased me down the street, and I ran down these subway stairs, and I had these cowboy boots on, you know, and I ate it about the last 15 stairs, man, just, you know, kadak. And I ran back up the other side of the stairways, and there was these cops on the corner of Market and Van Ness having lunch, and there was 8 of them, you know. They just grabbed me and threw me up against the wall. And my head's telling me, it's all because of those damn cowboy boots. That's why you got caught, you know. That's why I never wore cowboy boots again, you know. It's like, that's why you got caught. It took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to realize that it wasn't the police that were taking me to jail. It was me and my actions. You know, I was always doing something wrong. You know, but I just didn't care. You know, I didn't care. And alcohol didn't make me do anything. It let me. You know? And, you know, I was just constantly amazed. You know, I got these, stuff was just happening all the time. You know, somebody told me to tell this story tonight. I'm not sure why, but it's like, you know, when I was a kid, I was a teenager, and I got in this little traffic altercation with this guy at the intersection, you know. I grew up in this small town, and there wasn't very many traffic lights, but I happened to be at one of them. And I was talking to my buddy who was coming the other way, and we're holding up, you know, lots of people, you know. But, of course, I was loaded. I didn't care, you know. It was like, you know. And so this guy behind me gets really, really mad, and he taps my bumper and then takes off and goes around, you know. I was like, okay, it's on, you know. And so I chase this guy down, and, you know, and I'm half in the bag, you know. And it wasn't that he really did any, actually, it was my girlfriend's car, so I didn't really care that much, but, you know. But what I did care about was not looking bad, okay, and not being seen as afraid or a coward. So I chase this guy down, and while I'm dragging this guy out of the window of his car, I'm wondering why he comes out so easy. I slam him down on the ground, and I look down, and this guy has no legs, you know? I mean, this is the stuff that I did. I just could not get past that first thought. When it would come into my head, I had to do it, no matter how crazy it was, you know? And I started running with some, I guess it was, you know, we didn't call it, it wasn't really a gang back then, but this is what they were, you know? It wasn't like all this glamour stuff like it is today. But, you know, it was like, you know, we're just a bunch of guys that hung out at a park, you know, and you know, and fought a lot and stole a lot, you know, but, you know, it wasn't so publicized as it is now, you know, and it wasn't so big time. And, you know, and I like these guys because they like to drink and do drugs and steal and chase girls and catch girls, you know. I was like, hey, you know, so I was like, okay, but, you know, pretty soon, really short time after this, I started hanging out with these guys, people started dying really, really quick. And I was like, man, you know what? I mean, I love part of this, but you know what? I don't think I want to be into this, you know? And, you know, I watched the guy, you know, it's so ironic how this happens. You know, I watched the guy that I was hanging out with. We're in this bar down at Geneva Mission, which was pretty close to this park I was hanging out at in San Francisco, you know, and we're hanging out in this bar, and you know what? One of the guys we're hanging out with, you know, it wasn't like we were friends, but, you know, nobody really trusted each other 100%. You know, but we would fight against other people. But when the cops got us in separate rooms, it was kind of a different story, you know. I was like, oh, man, it was kind of each man for himself. But this guy, he stabbed a guy in the bar, and this was the second person that he had killed. He killed somebody before when he was a teenager, and he had an uncle that was on the police, San Francisco Police Department. He kind of got away with it the first time. And the second time, he didn't. You know, and I come 500 miles, to San Diego. I'm sitting in a meeting, and this little soccer mom, you know, walks into the meeting a few years ago and starts telling me that she grew up in this neighborhood and she knew these guys. I'm like, what a small world. She drives a white minivan, you know, she's a nurse. It's like, you know, I mean, only in Alcoholics Anonymous can these connections be made, you know, nowhere else. And she knew these guys, you know. I'm like, oh man, here we go, you know. And my drinking just continued to progress, you know. I got a girl pregnant, and, you know, she came to me after she had the baby, and everything inside of me wanted to do the right thing and marry this girl and take care of this kid, you know. I mean, everything inside of me, but I knew, it's like that t-shirt that says, you know, it's like the cops say, you know, you have the right to remain silent. Everything you say can and will be used against you. Well, I had the right, but I never had the ability, you know. That's me. I had the right to stop drinking, but I never had the ability. I had the right to raise this kid, but I never had the ability. And I knew that I could not even take care of myself. How am I going to take care of a girl and her baby? So I walked, you know. It was like, that was all I knew to do, is to walk. You know, either start swinging or run. That was my solutions to things. You know, and, you know, it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I didn't know how to, like, have confrontations with people either. You know, I didn't know how to speak my truths. So usually the first words I'm out of my mouth when I was, you know, something came up was always, hey, motherfucker. And it always went downhill from there, you know. And I didn't always understand why, you know. I didn't understand why until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and started listening to people interact with each other. You know, some people have to go to rehab. I was never had, so I couldn't be rehabbed, you know. I needed to start at the very, very beginning, you know, and to let go of all my old ideas and start emulating these guys that have been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while and looked like they hadn't missed a meal in a while, you know, and had a couple bucks in their pocket and were happy to be alive and were still telling stories to each other after 25 years and still happy to listen to them and still laughed at them. I was like, you know what? That's what I want. And my life progressed on and, you know, on and on, drinking constantly. I didn't care about anything else except getting loaded. And, you know, I finally reached a point, there's several points that I reached. And I had a lot of bottoms before I really got willing to do what it tells me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's just an insane life that I got to live. But what happened was by January 1987, I ended up being drug off to the hospital in a coma. And I'd known something had been wrong with me for about 8 or 9 months. I lost about 50 pounds. You know, I was just exhausted all the time. I was drinking massive amounts of fluids. I could not keep them down. I mean, get up in the middle of the night and drink a gallon of liquid, and 10 minutes later, I need another one. I was going to the bathroom all the time. I constantly had to pee. And, you know, I was so afraid to go to the doctor because I thought they were going to tell me I was going to have to stop drinking and doing drugs. And I was like, you know, that's like asking me to give up my God. It was like, you know what? This ain't going to happen. You know, I'll just die and that's okay. Well, God had other plans for me. So, you know, I came home from work one day, and I worked on the weekend sometimes, and my ex-girlfriend called 911, and they drug me off to the hospital in a coma. And I was in a coma for about a week, and I came out of the coma, I was still blind for a couple days, and they finally got my blood sugar stabilized, and I could start seeing again. And, you know, the doctors came to me and told me you almost died, and it was like, you know, and I was pissed that I came out of the coma. I was like, I still got to do this thing called life, man. I'm so sick of it. Every day was like going to war. You know, I had to cover up all the stuff I did yesterday and then still get enough to make it through today. And I was lying, cheating, stealing to do this. And, you know, the lies were getting harder to come up with. The schemes and the scams were getting harder to come up with. You know, and, they, you know, I was reaching this point where just, you know, I touched upon the book where, you know, life was becoming intolerable. And the doctors told me it would be a pretty good idea if I didn't drink anymore, you know. And I had two words for him. One was you, the other wasn't thanks, you know. It was like, you know, I mean, this is, you know, and I continued to drink. You know, now insulin dependent diabetes and alcohol don't go real good together. You know, it's not a real good combination. I have to take all these medicines now that tell me, you know, do not drink. You know, I didn't read those signs back then. You know, I didn't care. And by April of that year, I ended up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I volunteered to go into rehab because stuff was coming down. I was trying to get the heat off, you know, and I thought I could just go in there and BS my girlfriend and the job. And still keep my job and still keep my girlfriend and just kind of pretend like I'm going on with the stuff they were telling me and, you know, get out and then I'll be able to control my drinking and it won't be so bad, you know. I won't stay gone for weeks at a time, you know. I won't come home broke every time I show up, you know. It's like I won't be peeing my pants or crapping my pants, you know. It's like I'll show up for work, you know. That's what I thought. And truth was, as I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love the people and I love the stories, but what happened was I wasn't done drinking yet. And they started talking about God, and I thought, there's the catch. This is never going to work for somebody like me. Never. You know, all the horrible things, the people that I've hurt, lied, cheated, stole to, you know, this is never going to work for somebody like me. And I really didn't know too much about God. I never went to church. The first prayer I heard in my life was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my dad was very anti-religious and anti-church. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it except the guys on TV that wanted your money, and I knew that wasn't real attractive. You know, I mean, you know, Cameron said you can't bullshit a bullshitter. I knew those guys were full of it too, you know. But that's all I knew about it. And actually, I was kind of envious when I was a little kid and watched the other families go off to church because, you know, they were doing something together, you know, even if it was church, you know. And, you know, me and my brother got really good at, you know, we had a station wagon, and we got really good at diving from the back seat to the back of the station wagon. Because when that arm was coming around, man, you either ducked and moved, you know. It was like, okay. And these guys were going to church, and they looked reasonably happy. You know, I was like, wow, man, that's a trip. And I was envious of that. And, you know, so what I did is I tried to go to AA meetings, and I loved it, you know, but I just couldn't do any of the work, and I wasn't done drinking yet. And my drinking got real, you know, it really got bad, because when I got out of this rehab, I stayed sober for 30 days. Well, I didn't stay sober. I just didn't have a drink for 30 days, you know. It's like, man. And, you know, when I went back to work, and it's like, you know what? This ain't going to work for me, man. I might as well, you know, I knew the inevitable was going to come, so I might as well do it now and get it over with. And I just decided at that point, I'm just going to do as much and as hard as I can, and I'm just going to die. And that's okay with me, you know. So that's what I tried to do. You know, I was too afraid to kill myself, you know, the quick way, with a gun, or, you know, I didn't want pain, you know. So jumping off the bridge or something, that didn't seem real good, you know. And actually, you know, that's a, you know, it's not the jump, it's the fall. It's the landing, you know. It's like, oh, man, it's when you hit. You know, when we were little kids, we used to crawl out underneath that Golden Gate Bridge, and there'd be these ropes underneath there to catch the painters. And we could swing out over the under the bridge and drop off into these ropes that are about 70 or 80 feet down, you know, to catch the painters. You know, I'm scared to death of heights, but you get a little alcohol in me, and I'm leading the charge, you know. I'm leading the charge. But I really wanted to die, you know. I really did. And I did it for as long as I could, you know, and I ended up becoming homeless. And, you know, I became homeless when I was still working, you know. This didn't make any sense to me, you know. But every dime I had was going to alcohol and other stuff, you know. And I just slept in cars. I broke into people's cars to sleep. I slept in the bushes, you know. And I finally lost that job, you know. You know, the ironic thing is if I would have told the truth, they wouldn't have been able to fire me. But I told a lie, and they were looking for a lie. They were looking for all the reasons in the world to get rid of me, and I set them up. It was like, if I would have told them I was out drinking, they wouldn't have been able to fire me because alcohol's a disease, and they were already aware of it. But I made up some story again, and they fired me. And that's when things became really, really bad. You know, I had nowhere to go. And I started living in the bushes and, you know, trying to take care of, you know, diabetes requires that you take medicine and eat on a regular basis and stuff. And I wasn't doing any of that stuff, you know. I was living in the bushes and I was prying open the newspaper box at the corner of Market and Van Ness, stealing all the papers out of there to sell the papers to get enough money to get something to drink. And this is what booze had taken me, you know. It wasn't my goal when I was a kid. I just wanted to stop hurting inside. I wanted to stop feeling, and I wanted to stop wanting to die all the time. And you know what? This is what happened to me. And you know what? I got to this point where I don't know if I went to one too many AA meetings or what, but like it talks about in the 12 by 12, you know, it says, you know, maybe those AAs were right, you know? And you know what? That's what happened. Because Alcoholics Anonymous pissed in my drink, you know? It was never the same after that, you know? I could never enjoy drinking again. You know, it was never good after that. Because every time I drank, I could not get enough inside of me to shut off my brain anymore. Physically, I could be drunk, but mentally, I was sober as a fox. You know? And it was absolute torture. I don't ever want to go through that hell ever again. You know, and I would put massive amount of liquid in me. You know, and I got to this point where I was so saturated, I didn't, you know, sometimes I could go into a blackout after a couple of sips, you know, and just pass out. You know, and other times I'd be drinking quarts, you know. I was like, I didn't understand this at all. At all, but my body was so saturated that it couldn't process the amount of alcohol that I was putting into it. All these years, you know. And I finally gave up. you know, and for some weird reason, you know, it happened to be, you know, I've been on the streets and I knew something not real good had happened because for some reason I was in one of those piss in the sink hotel rooms in San Francisco, you know, one of those flop houses that didn't have a bathroom, but it did have a sink, you know, and it was just absolutely disgusting, but at least it was better than outside, you know. And there was a bottle of Jack Daniels sitting on this thing, like this little table thing, and it was like, man, something's wrong here, you know. And there were remnants of cocaine on the table. It's like, you know what, I haven't had that stuff in so long. I hadn't been inside in so long. Something, I must have done something really, really bad to get all this stuff, and I couldn't remember what it was. But that was that last night, you know. And I asked God to help me, you know, and that was the last thing that I thought would ever do. I really wanted to die, and it was either God or death, you know. And the book talks about this. You know, we have the two choices. One is going to the bitter end, blotting out our intolerable situation as best we can, and the other to accept spiritual help. And I thought, before I kill myself, I'm going to ask this. You know, and by then I'd had needles, so it would have been real easy to kill myself, you know. I couldn't believe they were giving me needles. You know, I used to stick them in my arm, and now they're giving them to me to stay alive. I was like, this doesn't make any sense, you know. But here I am, you know. And I asked this guy, God, who I didn't even believe in, didn't think existed, and especially didn't want anything to do with the sword of me, for help. And you know what? I didn't know it right then and there, but when I woke up kind of came to, actually. And I don't even know what day that was. You know, I know I picked my sobriety date because that was the first day that I walked into a meeting at the North Shore Zolano Club. You know, and that's the one I'm sure of. But this sequence of events started happening that were amazing. You know, I asked God for help. I came through the next day, and I had no desire to drink. And for the first time in my life, I had a sliver of hope that maybe if I didn't pick up a drink and got back to Alcoholics Anonymous, that maybe I could stop drinking. Maybe. I didn't trust it very much because it was all real new to me, you know, and I'd never felt like that before. And this weird set of circumstances, my brother and sister-in-law lived down in San Diego, and somehow I got in contact with them. I don't know how, you know. I hadn't had a phone in years, you know. Phones were luxury items, too, in my opinion, you know. Like, you know, I went and found people, and they went to find me when we needed to see each other. And, you know, but I got in touch with my brother and sister-in-law, and they said, look, if you want to stay sober, you can come down here and live with us in San Diego. There's a lot of club in walking distance. We live in PB. You know, I was like, you know what? That sounds wonderful. That sounds absolutely wonderful. Thank you. You know, and that ex-girlfriend that I had, she bought me my third plane ticket. The other two I'd cashed in. I'd used that line on before, you know. Yeah, I'm going to go to San Diego and live and it's over. So she'd buy me a ticket, and I'd go cashing in and spend the money. This time, you know, she bought me a ticket. She got me kind of cleaned up, and she walked all the way down to the end of the airport and made sure that door closed and I was on that plane, you know. You know, because I had been harassing her for months after she had told me to get out, you know. It was like, you know, I was like, okay, it's all your fault, you know. Yeah, right. And, you know, and I got on the plane and I sat down and, you know, and I mean, you know, a few hours, you know, a couple of days before, I'd been in the bushes, man. I was stinky, you know. I was just like, oh, man, it was absolutely disgusting. You know, I had dreadlocks before they're popular, you know. I was like, you know, it's like, okay. But, you know, what happened, and I was a lot younger then. I was still in my 20s, you know. And this little San Diego beach girl sits down next to me and says, oh, good, somebody young, we can party on the way down there. I'm like, you know what? And I put the headphones on, and I went to sleep. And I was like, you know, how did this happen? You know, I just couldn't believe this was happening to me, you know. And I hadn't been around, you know, there weren't too many girls lining up to come in the bushes with me, you know. I was like, you know, I hadn't been around there very much, many girls for a while. And it was like, you know, this looked pretty good. And it was like, you know what, here we go. It was just a testament to God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself right off the bat. You know, and I walked into the North Shore Zolano Club. And, you know, I was scared to death again, but I knew I didn't want to drink. That was the only thing I knew, you know, that I didn't want to drink. And I didn't care about anything else. I didn't care if I had to live under the Crystal Pier. I just didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want to feel the way that I felt that last night of drinking. Ever again. And you know, I felt a lot of other ways since I've been sober, but never like that. Thank God. Never like that. You know, when I started meeting some people, and, you know, it's just amazing. I'm still kind of attracted to the nuts, you know. And now I'm in a room full of the nuts, you know. It's like, you know, and then when I got to AA, they told me there's a wrench for every nut. And I was like, you know what, this might be the right place for me, you know. And I found quite a few, you know, that are just like me. And, you know, I started meeting people. And, you know, I remember sitting around the Alana Club, and it was like my first 30 days or something, you know. And I was absolutely dead broke, couldn't buy cigarettes, you know. I was like, you know, there used to be this guy that always shout and rave, you know, about, you know, cookies and milk because at 3 o'clock in the morning because he could, and I couldn't know exactly what that man was talking about. He talked about, you know, tailor-made smokes and gourmet coffee, and I knew what he was talking about. He'd stand up at the podium and pull out his underwear because he had some, you know, like, I knew what he was talking about, you know. You know, it was like, you know, I was attracted to the characters, and, you know, and it was just proof to me that I was in God's grace. You know, it was like I had no desire to drink. And me and these great guys that were sitting around in the Alana Club, none of us really wanted to go to work. We were still kind of looking for the easier, softer way, you know. So we came up with this great idea that we're, you know, that, you know what? You know, we can go take out a drug dealer once or twice a year, take all his shit, sell it and steal all his money and just kill him and take his ass out to the desert and bury him. And, you know, we could do this, you know. I mean, I could have lived with that, you know. That's what I thought, you know. It's like, hey, he knows the risk when he got into this business, you know. It's like, okay. And so we were pretty convinced we were going to do this, you know. I was like, hey, you know, this isn't such a bad idea. And then I went to my sponsor and he told me to go get a job. You know, and this is the kind of thing that I need other people in my life for, especially sponsors, you know, because I was coming up with some really great ideas still, you know. And it wasn't my problems that got me into trouble. It was always my solutions to those problems that got me into trouble. Always. You know, my best thinking landed me in jails, institutions, and near death, and then Alcoholics Anonymous. That was my best thinking. That was the best I could do. Estranged from my family, you know, anybody that had ever loved me, I drank away and pushed away or thrown away. You know, I ended up all by myself, and I thought that's what I wanted, but man, I found out different. That's not what I really wanted. And so I got a job. You know, my first job, I was working in a convenience store selling booze with a box full of money in the middle of the night, you know, and they left me alone in the store, and I was laughing, you know. I'm like, you guys, man, are crazy. You know, you don't know who you're leaving in this store, you know. But they did know. They knew more than I knew, you know, because they trusted me. And I was like, oh, my God. And it had been such a long time since I had been trusted, you know. And I started, like, doing, it was absolutely weird that I started doing the right thing very, very soon after I got sober. You know, like I didn't steal from that store. I was like, wow. You know, and the guys would come in and offer me drugs after 2 o'clock in the morning for booze. And I'd say, you know, my head would be going, where were you guys a couple months ago? But, you know, but my actions were, no, you guys got to get the hell out of here. I'm not going to sell you any booze. And I don't want any of your drugs, you know. And I would stand back. It was like these out of body experiences. It was like, who said that? You know, who said that? You know. I was like, oh, my God. And I remember walking down Garnet Avenue and somebody from a meeting honked and waved at me because I saw my face at a meeting and remembered me. And I was like, oh, my God. I couldn't remember the last time that had happened, you know. And I was like, man, there's one more thing. Like, you know what? Maybe this is going to work. Maybe this is going to work, you know. But I was still very unsure because I'd been a screw-up for so long. And, you know, stuff that always looked good to me before would always be great at the beginning, but it always turned out bad. Always, you know. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, was going to be like that, too. It took a long time before I really believed that I could stay sober one day at a time if I followed directions in the book for the rest of my life. But that took a long time. I believe it now. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I do believe it, you know. But, you know, and, you know, these miracles started happening. You know, I was able to get a car when I was about 3 months sober. You know, a guy I worked with, and there's some old lady whose husband had died, and I ended up getting this totally cherry old 66 Chrysler for $350, you know. I mean, I was like, you know, and that was a lot of money to me back then, you know. I was like, wow. And I bought this car, and, you know, she had personal license plates on it, you know. So she took the place because she wanted them because they're ex-husbands, you know. And I got this car, and you know what? I waited until I could get insurance. And I hadn't had a driver's license in 10 years either. So, you know, and I went and got a driver's license. I waited till I could get insurance. And I waited till I could have license plates on this car before I started driving it. I was like, who is this guy? Who is this guy? I could never wait for anything before. Never. You know? And I was doing the right thing. I was like, this is amazing. And I was paying back my brother and sister-in-law because they got me some... I didn't have any... You know, the only thing I showed up with today was I had this grip, you know. And for some reason, I had this old 1960s dial clock radio that when I could get a flop house room that I'd plug it in and listen to all this talk radio. And those were my friends, you know. Those were my friends. So I carried this radio around like it was my best friend's. And another pair of corduroys. That's all I had, you know. But I still ended up with this radio. No matter what, I always held on to it. And I was like, okay. And my sister-in-law got me clothes and stuff, and, you know, I was like, I was so indebted to them, and they fed me, and they kept the roof over my head long enough for me to get a job, you know, and find somewhere to live, and it was like, oh, my God, you know, and they ended up buying a house pretty soon after that because my sister-in-law got pregnant, and it was out by college, and it was just, you know, it was a house that some people had lived in for a really long time, you know, and had that glossy institutional green paint wall to wall everywhere, you know, and I went in there and ripped out this old raggedy shag carpet with my brother and helped them paint every inch of that house, inside and outside, so they could move in. You know, I was finding myself doing these things that I'd never been able to do before. You know, I'd never been able to help anybody else out unless there was something in it for me. And it had to be better than what I was giving. And I found myself starting to do these things almost automatically. You know, I was willing to help. I was willing to do anything to stay sober. You know, cleaning ashtrays. You know, I remember I loved the meetings when there was so much smoke in those meetings, man. It was like, but I was still smoking then, so I loved it. Now I don't smoke. I'm glad they don't. You know, like, you know. But, you know, I was cleaning ashtrays and emptying coffee cups and wiping down tables and mopping floors, you know, and I didn't even know why. And it didn't matter, you know. And you know what? It was so weird because I get up, you know, I still didn't really know any prayers, but I would say please in the morning. I'd say the serenity probably about 8,000 times throughout the day when I was new. And then I'd say thank you at night. And that's the best I could do. And you know what? That's pretty much still what I do today. You know, please and thank you. That's pretty simple prayers. And God's been doing that for me for a long time now, you know. And I've got to experience all kinds of things sober. You know, I've been married, you know, and I've been divorced. You know, I got to do it all. You know, and I didn't know how to be married. You know, I had still have these illusions, these old ideas about marriage. And I based that on my parents' relationship. You know, I thought as long as nobody was getting hit, I had a good marriage. You know? And I found out differently, that there's a whole lot more in marriage than just that. You know? And I didn't know how to do it. And my ex-wife had expectations, and I couldn't fulfill them. And, you know, I had expectations, and she couldn't fulfill those either. And, you know, it was like, wow, this is probably the best thing, you know. And that's what happened. You know, I've gotten in car wrecks sober. I've been in the hospital sober. I got health problems still today, more now than I did then, you know. I mean, this is just life. This is part of getting older. But what I do is get to stay sober one day at a time. But I've also had some absolutely wonderful experiences since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. These miracles have been happening to me over and over and over again. You know, I remember the first time, I can still remember the first time I woke up in PB hearing the birds sing. You know, it wasn't like they'd been gone for 29 years. It's just I'd never heard them, you know. You know, I used to, man, you know, it was just like, wow. You know, it was just amazing. And my boss, you know, my first boss at that convenience store would hand me the bank stuff for the weekend and tell me to take it to the bank. And I'm like, I don't know, you know, it's like 10 grand in cash. I'm like, you know, I don't know if this is a good idea, you know. She says, I trust you. And I go down there and take the money back and get the receipts and come back to work. It's like, wow, you know. And people in AA were helping me all the time, you know. And I didn't really realize how much I needed people. And I still don't like admitting that I need people, you know. I really don't. But you guys, man, without you guys, I wouldn't be here. You know, one alcoholic talking to another. You know, and I finally got to the point where I was willing to do the rest of the steps. You know, I'm one of those guys that could stay sober on the first three steps for about 2.5 years. And the pain got so bad, you know, because my life changed so dramatically just by putting down the drink. You know, I got to move indoors and start bathing, and, you know, I didn't get those looks from people anymore like I used to, and people didn't make this big wide circle on the sidewalk around me like they used to, like they thought they were going to catch something. It was like, and they weren't dragging their kids away from me, you know. I was like, oh, okay. You know, I was able to get employed, and the outside stuff started changing. But the inside stuff hadn't changed enough. And I got to be 2.5 years sober, and I got on one of those boy meets girl on AA campus relationships. And woo! Talk about pain, man. You know, I mean, I got to feel it like I'd never felt it before. And it was like, you know what? I was either going to kill myself or take the steps. And I'm glad that I had that choice. And I took the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't looked back since. The teacher talks about, I'm not supposed to mention names. Your speaker last week talks a lot about being rocketed into the fourth dimension. My experience is I've done a lot more trudging than I have rocketing, you know, which just means to walk with purpose, you know, and it figures that, you know, rocketing is in the front part of the book and trudging is in the back, you know. It's like, you know, Bill kind of sets the hook for the newcomer, reels him in, and then he gives him the real truth at the end, you know. It's like, okay, you know, he was a salesman. It's like, okay. But this has just been my life, you know. This has been my life sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and it's turned out so much different than I ever thought it could have. You know, and I'm not talking about the money and that kind of stuff. I'm grateful that I live indoors. You know, I still don't get these things. I have these AA camping trips twice a year. That makes no sense to me. I spent 20 years trying to stay indoors, you know. Going out and sleeping in the dirt does not sound like a lot of fun to me, you know. I'm like, I just don't get it. But, you know, it's like blows me away. It blows me away. You know, but some people really enjoy that stuff, and that's fine. But I really love, you know, I love waking up and I'm in a bed. I love being able to go into the bathroom and close the door. I like not having to wait in line for food. And that fact that I can pick whatever I want to eat. And you know what? One of the greatest things that I get to do is walk into a grocery store. And you know what? And I feel like, you know, a billionaire when I walk in there, because I can buy anything I want to eat in there. You know, and I know how to cook it. And I don't have to shove it down my pants. And I actually have, I actually have somewhere where I can cook it. You know, I used to buy the stuff, get the stuff, but it always had to be made ahead of time. You know, because I had nowhere to cook. You know, it's like, oh man, you know, and I can do this stuff today. You know, and I can take a shower whenever I want to. You know, and I can make a cup of coffee whenever I want to. You know, these choices and freedoms that I didn't have before. You know, and the greatest thing is, you know, it's when I wake up in the morning, my first thought is not, oh fuck, you know. And that's what it used to be every day. I gotta do this again. You know, most of the time, you know, I don't usually wake up, you know, and zippity-doo-dah, zippity-day, but, you know, it's still a whole lot better than it was. And I say please, and I get out of bed, and I do what I'm supposed to do, you know. And most days that includes going to work, you know. And I'm grateful that I have a place of employment, you know. And, you know, it's just amazing how this worked. I hadn't worked in an office in years, and, you know, I go to a meeting a few years ago and somebody tells me that I should be working for her. And I'm like, you're crazy, you know. I had no desire to work in an office, you know. I've been outside and my own schedule and I could do whatever I wanted to. And, you know, and now it's been almost 2 years that I've been working in this office. I've never touched a computer in my life, you know. And they wanted me to, and, you know, she said, well, you're going to have to work with computers a bit, you know. Yeah, a bit, yeah, 8 hours a day, you know. I was like, you know, it's like, here we go, just like Bill, setting that hook, you know. I was like, okay. You know, and I said, you know, I don't know anything about this stuff. And she says, don't worry. Just, you know, you're willing, and I know that, and we will teach you. And that was kind of a hard stretch for me to believe, too. But again, I did what I've been taught to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got humbled, and I became willing to do whatever it took. And that's what I learned in here, is to be willing, and be willing to ask questions, and be willing to look like a newcomer when you are a newcomer. You know, and I was to this employment thing, you know. And I went in there, and you know what? I've been working there for almost 2 years now. And I almost know what I'm doing, you know? And the real good news is that everybody else thinks I really know what I'm doing, you know? It's like, wow, I got them all fooled, you know? Well, not all of them, because there's at least one other alcoholic there, and I know I don't have her fooled, you know? But, you know, and, you know, the good news is we don't have to pretend that we know what we're doing, or that we even have a clue about any of this stuff. And we can laugh and joke about most of it. Not all, but most. And, you know, it's amazing to have health benefits today. And, you know, I've been in the hospital about 7 times in the last, 10 months for my heart. And if I hadn't had this job, I wouldn't have health benefits, and I wouldn't got taken care of like I have been. You know, it's just the way that these things seem to happen. You know, I also have insulin-dependent diabetes. I went to the doctor last week. You know, I went to the dentist and got all new teeth. I still have 6 of my original teeth. I'm pretty happy about that, you know. It's like, hey, you know, it was fine. You know, and it was long overdue. You know, but when I got the job with benefits, I was like, you know what? I got to take advantage of this. You know, and I went to the doctor a couple weeks ago, and I was like, man, he found a hernia, and then he found some skin spot on my back that he's all freaked out about. And I'm like, God, you know, then Monday I had to go to the eye doctor, and I'm like, what's this guy going to tell me? You know, I'm like, man, every time I go somewhere, they tell me something's wrong with me. It's like being married again. I'm like, oh, man, you know, it's like, God, no, thank you, you know. And, you know, and I went to the eye doctor on Monday, and you know what? He told me to go to Costco and buy these glasses, and I don't have any, you know, broken blood vessels, and then there's no glaucoma, and, you know, I was like, I was very grateful. But I was really grateful that I could go to the doctor today, that I wasn't afraid, you know? I was like, wow, this is kind of cool. And, you know, if you would ask me what my life would have looked like, you know, a little over 20 years ago, I would not be picturing this, you know? No way. I didn't think I was going to stay. You know, I thought there's no way that anything could ever work for somebody like me. And, you know, it does work. It works really, really well. I need to do my part, though. And the book talks about that there are clear-cut directions. And when I follow the directions, I do really, really good. You know, and, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm sober despite my best efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've made several mistakes. I've done a lot of stupid shit sober. But yet I still get this gift of grace because, you know, whenever I do something that I know is not okay, I make it right. Whatever I got to do to make it right. And this is what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Before, I would run or hide or fight. And today I don't do that stuff, at least not for a while, you know. I still like to fight probably more than most people do, you know. It's like, ugh. But I haven't had to in a little while now, and I'm grateful for that, too. You know, and if you, you know, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I got a divorce from my ex-wife, and she got the, you know, I get always getting them gold mine relationships. You know, I get the shaft, she gets the gold, you know. It's like, all right. And so she ended up with the house, and, you know, you just never know how things are going to turn around, though. And it just blows me away that I get to live sober one day at a time. And, you know, this man from Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come live at his house after I left my ex-wife. And for the first time, you know, in my whole life, I actually felt like I lived in a home where I was comfortable and safe and where I was okay to be me. And that was, you know, that was like 6 or 7 years ago. For the first time in my life, I was like, wow, you know, and I love living this way. And there's no better deal in town for me than Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I'm here because I'm not all there. And you know what? The greatest gift of all is taking another man through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous without a doubt. I never had anything to give before. Never. And now I have to, what I gave is what was given to me here freely. And that is the greatest gift in the world, is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to see the lights come on in somebody else's eyes, the way that they came on in mine, is an absolute miracle. You know, and I'm here to tell you, it's just possible to stay sober one day at a time. And I've been watching people for a long time. You know, I go to a meeting usually on Saturday night where this lady just took a 58-year cake. I love this lady, you know, and she loves me too. It's so cool. It's absolutely so cool to be a sober member of the human race today. And I don't know, I think I'm running out of gas. Trust God, clean house, help others. Thanks.